It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Rod Sasha. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Interviews recorded years ago with some of the most accomplished and most respected outdoorsmen and women in Alaska. I'm your host, Randy Zarnke, and I'm excited to share today's program with you. We will be listening to excerpts from an interview with Ron Long. Ron was a very successful trapper here in the Fairbanks area. In addition, Ron dabbled in buying fur. He was also one of the leaders in the Alaska Trappers Association. As you listen, you'll notice that Ron had a real sense of humor. In this first segment, Ron talks about his youth in Oklahoma, how he came to Alaska, and how he got started trapping.
Well, I came to Alaska in 1956 in the Air Force. I had two choices. I'll tell you how crazy I was. I had Alaska or the Azores, and I came to Alaska. But I'd always wanted to come, even when I was a little kid. I started trapping when I was I was 8 years old. So the adventure of Alaska, even when I was young, always intrigued me.
So you grew up in Oklahoma, is that right?
Yeah, I'm an Okie. I was raised in central Oklahoma, a little place called Noble. I was kind of lucky. I was right on the edge of the prairie country and what they call the blackjacks. So in the trap, I got pretty good variety. The biggest thing down in that country we trapped were coyotes. And we used to get about $3.50 a head for the bounty. It wasn't real good money, but it spending money, especially when I was in high school. I also trapped Colorado for a couple winters. That was cat trapping. And that's where I learned a lot of things about bobcat and also coyotes. Coyotes got awful smart in that country about the 50s because you had government trappers after them. And they got awful hard to catch.
How did you get started trapping after you got here in Alaska?
I started trapping around town, in the outskirts of town. There wasn't too many people, so I'd trap on Gold Stream and on a Chena. There was a lot of fur, and there wasn't very much competition. Big money in those days were two animals, and that was beaver and mink. And the rest of them, boy, you didn't get much money for them. I mean, when I got $7 for fox, I thought I was doing something. But beaver at that time were bringing about what they're bringing now. They're bringing almost $50. And good mink was bringing about 30. By the way, gas is about 50 cents a gallon.
The last 20 years, you've been trapping out in the flat.
I had a friend of mine. He's an Eskimo kitty. I seen him not too long ago in Indiana, too. And we were getting laid off of work. I was working for the railroad in the summertime. And he said, you should go over that Clear Creek. He said, a lot of mink over there. And I said, well, how'd you do last year? And he said 38 mink. And that was a lot of mink. You should go over and try that. And I said, well, yeah, maybe I better. So that was the beginning of going over Clear Creek. Clear Creek, let me tell you, doesn't look anything like Clear Creek looks today. I mean, the creek looked the same. There wasn't a track over there. I mean, a human track. There was nothing. There wasn't anything within a mile of Fairbanks going south. There was nobody over there. First few years, we used tents in there, small tents. We trapped primarily mink and beaver, like I said before, where the money was, and that's what we concentrated on. As we started moving out with snow machines, our mink catches started increasing. So the 37 mink that he caught was nothing after a few years, as we could move out and get into the other creek. Pretty soon we was going all the way to Wood River, and we was going over almost to Blair Lake, and we was going over to Willow Creek, and we was going all over the country. And we're catching a lot more animals. And so that 30 come to 16, and 60 come to 17, and 18, and 19, and we're getting up to 100. Then, in between those, you'd have those down periods. What I mean down periods is where there wasn't hardly any mink at all, because there wasn't a feed in there for them sometimes. But in good years, there was a lot of mink, and very good quality mink, by the way. And then it was always tremendous lean country. And I don't remember the year exactly. I think it was 1971 that I was over there. It looked like link had fell out of the sky. I said, Lord have mercy. It looked like a rabbit track. Guys talk about link now, they don't even know what they're talking about. They had trails. And I called him, my brother-in-law, and anchor, and I said, Roy, so what are you doing? He said, nothing. I said, well, come on up, boy. Said, I tell you what, there's some link in this country. He said, you think we can catch 100? I said, man, that's a lot of link. But we'll try. And Roy was that time a tall, skinny native kid, and boy, he was a tough son of a gun. Really good on a trap line, one of the best I ever seen. You just tell Roy, I think we need a trail over there. And you come back 3 days later, that trail will be there. And he was excellent at that. So we started trapping. Link were bringing about, at that time, they weren't bringing too much. They were bringing about 60 or 70 bucks, maybe a little less. We wound up with 270-some link. The next year, we got over 100, and the next year, we got over 100. But you got to remember, with no competition, because we had nobody around. People started sneaking in on us, you know what I mean? Where they found out we was catching, they started coming in, you know. But they didn't really affect us because there were so many link in there.
In this next segment, Ron describes using a dog team for transportation on the trap line and how he trained his dogs to become members of his daughter's racing team.
Ron trapped for a number of years with a dog team. That's something most of you guys have never done, I'm sure. Tell us a few stories
about dogs. Well, at the time, there wasn't any other way to go. They didn't start snow machines till the 70s or in that area where they got halfway decent, so the only thing we had is dogs. Everybody that was trapping had a dog team. Some guys used 2 to 3, 4 dogs. Some guys used 7, 8, up to 9 dogs. All the villages used dogs for trapping, and they had their advantages and disadvantages. One of the biggest disadvantages, you had to feed them all summer. And boy, that was a son of a gun. And you had to be there with them. You had to get somebody to watch them for you. Another thing was you had to get that feed. At that time, we had a fairly cheap source of feed, and that was fish. And we could go out on a tanner at that time, and if you had a permit with a couple nets, you could get enough fish for your dogs. Another big disadvantage with dogs, if you got 2 foot of snow, you were done. And then you started snowshoeing in front of the dogs. And that was not any fun, by no means. But it kept you in shape, I'll tell you that. But what we used to do is we'd get two guys, would alternate if we had to break trail like that. One guy would run on a snowshoe the head of the dogs, another guy would hold the dogs, and he would catch up with him, and the other guy would take his place and break trail, and he'd just alternate that way, back and forth. And it was pretty good. But if you had a bad snowy winter with a lot of blow, man, you were having a heck of a time. So that, when the snow machines come out, it was really a godsend. I remember some of the guys talking about snow machines and said, man, you know, you can take these snow machines, and they're not too good, but you can follow a moose track, and you can break trail. None of those skidoos, the old skidoos. And I thought, man, that's a heck of a deal. And that's what started. We started getting into snow machines, and then I had dogs and snow machines for a while. But there was one thing about snow machines, especially those skidoos, they would break down. Those dogs wouldn't. And just where you think you wasn't going to break down, Pete can verify this, boom, there would go an axle, or there would go something you couldn't fix. I mean, there's a lot of things you can fix on a snow machine, but when you break a drive axle, you're done.
How far are you guys we walked that night?
Well, I think 150 miles. What do you think? God, it seemed like 150 miles, didn't it? We couldn't get any further than that. Now, the farthest I went, we were so damn far over there, it was the end of the world, and the axle goes boom. And I said, oh my God. And we started walking. What time did we start walking? About
3 o'clock in the afternoon. It was just getting dark.
Oh my God.
How many dogs did you usually run when you ran a trap line team?
I ran 7 dogs. Now, what I did, I trained the dogs for competition, too, and I had some pretty good dogs. And my daughter, at that time, she was racing dogs, and I had an advantage over most people because I had a brother-in-law that was he still is a dog racer, and he had some awful fine dogs, and he lived right next to me, so I could get some awful good dogs from him. We didn't run all the races. I shouldn't say that, but we ran the majority of races we ran. She did, in the juniors. She went from the 2-dog on up to the 7-dog. But I wouldn't let my dogs, what I call tree trot. Dogs ran all the way. When we went from one set to the other, we ran. There wasn't any plan. And what I would do, I would break my dogs down into real small teams, and I'd drag tires behind them to muscle them up in the fall. And I could actually go some places faster with dogs than I could with snow machines. You get a real windy trail, so the dogs will beat a snow machine. You get a fast open trail, naturally a machine will outrun them. But you get a windy trail, boy, dogs will whip through that. I'll tell you, they'll go like crazy. So I had some very good dog team. And like I said, I had some daughters to keep care of them at home, so that helped.
People never think about the fact that there's certain types of country where the guy can trap with dog team, but he can't trap with snow dog.
Oh, absolutely.
Hilly country where you got to go up a real steep little chute. Sometimes you just can't do it with a snow machine. Even as good as snow dogs are today, there's just certain limitations.
Place where you got a lot of creeks, a steep bank, dogs are really advantage there. There's dog men, and then most people are snow machine people because you can turn that snow machine off in the spring and you don't have to worry about it till the fall. Yeah, that's a big advantage of snow machines.
What do you think are some of the key things in training a dog team for trap line?
The leaders are the big things on trap line. You got to have a dog that's a good leader. That was a big thing for us. We wanted fast dogs. We didn't want any slow dogs. Like I said, we didn't trot. The only time we'd ever break down the trot is where it was getting tough.
What do you think the average trapper that ran dog team back 50s and 60s, what do you think he would put on that team in a day?
Oh, maybe 20 miles. Well, people didn't care about how fast they went or anything. They weren't training for that. They were just training to haul. A dog can haul a lot of weight, and they can drag a lot of weight.
Especially if you got a good trail.
Oh, absolutely. It makes a lot of difference.
In this next segment, Ron covers a lot of ground on various aspects of trapping. He combines personal experiences with his own interpretation and opinions.
Other than the natural cycle that animals go through, what do you think? Is the population of fur bears, is things down or up?
I would say there's probably more. Probably trapping has something to do with it. I know over in my area, there seems to be a lot of fur. There's one exception to that is fox. We used to have a tremendous fox population over there, and we don't have it anymore. I don't know why. We have a fairly good wolf population. We got a good mink population, and this year we had a tremendous mink population. Now, I didn't trap any mink because I couldn't find anybody that would give the money that I thought I should have got for them, so we didn't trap them. But there was a lot of mink in that country.
What was your biggest fox catch?
Oh, it's not very much. About 125. That was the best I ever did.
How about your best marten catch?
I've never caught a lot of marten, 75, 80. I don't have the country.
Did you get into woven?
Oh, yeah, we catch wolverines. We didn't catch any this year, by the way. I seen a couple tracks. But, boy, they're getting hard to find now. You know, the price is getting up on them. Seen two tracks all this winter, and they were traveling. Boy.
So was your biggest beaver catch?
We caught a lot of beaver. I don't remember how many beaver we caught, but we caught a lot of them. But there's always a problem after you get all those beaver that you got to skin them. Man, that was really a chore.
How about otters, Rod?
I'm not much of an otter trapper, I tell you what. There used to be quite a few otter out there, but they're not the otter population like they used to be. So we used to catch them on beaver houses, just about like we did mink. And we catch a few under the ice. But I never went after them because there wasn't enough money to be made in them. You know, you might catch two or three of them a season, and that's about all. I think one year we caught seven or eight, I think. Our marten over there is not looking too good. I don't know the reason. I know that the marten population is down. We've always had marten, but not a tremendous amount.
You think it went down when the length cycle went up?
Yeah, absolutely. The reason is because of the rafters. A lot of people think they kill the marten. Well, they don't kill the marten. They might get a few. It's the owls and the hawks that come in after the rabbits, and a marten is a setting duck for them. I went 16 miles the other day. I'll take out a survey to see what I've got, you know, for the next year. See, one trapping. I mean, there's no marten. And the funny thing about it, the year before last, when I did trap, there was marten all over. You couldn't keep them out of the trap.
Do you have a certain time of the year that you pull your marten set?
I only usually set marten for about 2 months. That's it. It's not pull out. Yeah, I don't even start for December 1st on marten because I can't get across the river. So, you know, I just try to get over and start. My marten are way over there. I'm almost way on the other side of the Wood River area, a long ways from Tanana. The first man I ever knew, the snaring Fairbanks, was Tom Whitmire. And that's where the gang sitting come in. And he used to get the meat from the base out there. He was a butcher, and that's how he made those sets. And that's the first time I had ever seen that work. Now, where he learned that, I'm not really sure. But that's been many, many years ago. So those gang sets are not new. They've been around for many, many years. They're very productive sets if you want to catch multiple wolves.
Around the one species you haven't hit on is wolves. I'm sure you got a lot to say about wolves.
Well, no, not too much. Actually, I'm not a big wolf trapper. We catch a few over there. I will tell a story about a wolf. A funny thing that happened to me one time. We sit in the cabin, a real quiet night, you know, one of those real pretty nights, cold. And I went out, so I could hear these wolves howling in a place we call Duck Lake. And I said, you know, Wendell, I suppose wolves are howling over there, man. I said, I just wonder if we got a few wolves in there. I said, we put a lot of traps in there. I said, I'll tell you, tomorrow we'll go over just to see if you got any. And that's one of the very few places I used to put a lot of traps in, because at that time it was a pretty good sized pack going through. And we went over there, and that's the only time it's ever happened to me. We had seven wolves in traps. I usually use steel draggers, 8-foot chain on them. And you can tell where they're going, because they would cross. You see what I mean? But we found them all, except one. Now, this is a story. So one of them we couldn't find. And what he did, he had a wood taco, he busted a taco. So I said, well, that's one gone, you know. So about maybe 3 weeks or a month later, no, about 15 miles south of the cabin, and it used to be set there. I always used an old moose horn that every animal that came by, a male, would always urinate on that horn, always. I don't care if it was a wolf, or it was a lynx, or it was a fox, they'd all hit it. You know, I've caught so many animals off that thing. So I'm going up there. I had dogs with me that time. I stopped, the place just tore to pieces. I looked back and I could see something back. I could tell what it was. So I got 22 pistol. And I'm looking at, here's this wolf, black one. The first thing I noticed is he's been in a trap. That's the one that got away. And most wolves, when you come up to them, are not aggressive. I don't care what anybody tells you. They're very, very docile. And I walked up to that son of a gun and I looked at him and he's watching me. And I took the gun out and said, well, this is going to be it, right? And just about the time I was ready to squeeze off, and boom, boy, that son of a gun, here he come. And he jumped at me, the only wolf I ever seen do that. And the only thing that stopped him from getting me was a chain and the drag. You talk about scaring stuff. Man, I emptied that pistol as fast as I could. And that was the end of that wolf. But that was the only aggressive wolf that I've ever seen that ever jumped at me. Most of them will try to get away from you.
Let's take a break now and hear from some of our sponsors. Welcome back to Alaska Tracks. We appreciate our sponsors and hope you support them. Now getting back to Ron Long, Ron was widely recognized for his success with lynx. In this next segment, he shares some of his know-how.
Can you compare the size of the peak now to the size of the peak that you witnessed in the 70s?
Well, there was at least three times as many because I caught four times as many. I think now we got 70 lynx, but that's nowhere near what there were there. I mean, there were lynx everywhere. And I'm not exaggerating when I say there were trails. It looked like rabbit trails going through there. And where they came from, the amazing thing, it seemed like it just came overnight. It was hungry there for 2 or 3 years, and all of a sudden, boy, they were there. It was something to see.
What was your favorite set for all those lynx?
My favorite set is a natural cubby set. I don't build any of these cubbies out of trees and try to make a Waldorf or a story out of a bunch of things. Like, I don't do that. What I do is I find an old tree down or a stump or a clump of weeds, whatever, and I make a natural cubby. I don't want to take any time to make these houses. I don't put a lot of sets in either. I put very few sets. When we was catching the big link, the maximum amount of set we had in was around 100. And now I doubt if I've got over 60. I could change that set a little bit and it would become a fox set by changing the locality.
I've been in people's trap lines, and it looked, you couldn't hardly put a foot down without having a trap. You don't have to do that. You look for quality places to put your trap, and you'll catch your animals. But don't be putting those traps all over.
I have a friend of mine, he used to put 6 or 8 sets on a beaver house. The animal couldn't get away from it. It was ridiculous. You could do the same thing with one trap. And the very most, 2 traps. But beaver house, another thing. Beaver houses are very good, most of you guys know here. Abandoned or live beaver houses are very, very good for lynx and almost any animal, particularly lynx and mink.
Ron had a love-hate relationship with snow machines. In this next segment, he relates some of the downside of motorized transportation on the trap line.
So that when the snow machines come out, it was really a godsend. I remember some of the guys talking about snow machines and said, man, you can take these snow machines and they're not too good, but you can follow a moose track and you can break trail. None of those skidoos are old skidoos. And I thought, man, that's a heck of a deal. And that's what started. We started getting into snow machines, and then I had dogs and snow machines for a while. But there was one thing about snow machines, especially those skidoos, they would break down. Those dogs wouldn't. And just where you think you wasn't going to break down, Pete can verify this, boom, there would go an axle. Or there goes something you couldn't fix. I mean, there's a lot of things you can fix on a snow machine, but when you break a drive axle, you're done.
How far do you actually walk that night?
Well, I think 150 miles. What do you think? God, it seemed like 150 miles, didn't it? We couldn't get any further than that. Now, the farthest I went, we were so damn far over there, it was the end of the world. And the axle goes boom. And I said, oh my God. And we started walking. What time we start walking? About
3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's just getting dark.
Oh my God.
Is that the farthest you ever walked back?
Well, I walked back quite a few times. No, I think probably at one time I went through the overflow. We used to Clear Creek years ago. That was probably the furthest I walked. That was a long ways. I was tired. But I did. I thought I could make it doing real fast. So what I was doing, I'd walk and I'd sit down to rest and walk some more. Well, when I finally got to cabin, I was only walking about 50 yards and sitting down. Man, I knew that I was wearing it completely out. But naturally, I made it there. You get no swamps, the flats. I don't care if the Tanoff flats or Yukon flats or Minto flats or wherever flat it is. You're going to go through ice. You're going to get an overflow. You're going to get stuck. And I broke through my share. And I ruined a lot of snow machines because when you want to put a snow machine under, that's it. You can get it started and run it, but it takes the life right out of it.
How do you get them
out? I carry winches because I knew I was going to go in. It's a matter of time. But these big machines I got now, and you cannot get it out by yourself. You put it down through the ice, one guy, you might well forget about it. And I don't care who you are. Because I got one creek outside of the cabin. It's 12 foot deep and it's going down. And I don't care what kind of winch you got. You're not going to get it up by yourself. Two guys might be able to do it. We got a rope winch now. But the last couple of years have been pretty good. I haven't went down through the ice the last couple of years. But
I never knew anybody that told the truth that messed around those flats very often, didn't go through overflow or ice.
As mentioned earlier, Long was a leader in the Alaska Trappers Association. In this next segment, he describes how the organization got started.
He's considered the father of APA by most people.
Yeah, absolutely. I wasn't at the first meeting. It was Norman Phillips, Terry Johnson, and 4 or 5 other guys started the organization. Norman and I talked about it, but I was up in the mountain somewhere, and they got together and started. The first meeting I wasn't at. The second meeting I was, but we had no idea it would last as long as it did. But we knew we was in trouble because the antis were starting to make inroads. We had to organize.
You think Fabian or anybody had any idea of the battles that were ahead?
Oh, I think we knew there was going to be battles. I don't think we knew what the association would have got as strong as it is now, though. Because it started just a bunch of trappers. We just hoped something would happen, and it did. A lot of people put a lot of time in this thing in the early days, so it was a struggle. And by the way, there's been ups and downs in the association. There's been a few down times, too, that I was worried about it wouldn't survive, but it pulled through.
So you knew
Fabian? Yeah, Fabian was trapping up in the Mechumen at that time, and he was a few years older than I was. And he used to bring some awful big catches out of Mechumen, awful big marten catches. I was kind of fascinated with that because at that time there wasn't many marten around this country, believe it or not. But he would always bring those big catches, nice big marten. He was a very nice guy, and he was very helpful to other trappers.
As he became more well-established in the trapping community, Ron gravitated towards buying fur. In this next segment, he shares some of his unique methods of interacting with customers.
I heard from other people, when they sell fur to you, you'd always say, write down what you think this stuff is on a piece of paper. What was that all about?
Well, I did do that.
You know, it's kind of funny how these trappers are, but they'd be sitting in a cabin, it'd have three or four martin on the wall. What they'd do, they'd go by this martin, and every time they go by it, they'd pet it. The time I pet it, it went up $5. When they got it to me, it was so damn high, I couldn't even buy it. Even a $15, $20 martin at the time, it was worth $100. I'm serious. So what I'd do, I'd say, well, what do you think that's worth? And the guy'd say, I don't know. Well, I'll sit here, just write it down on paper. I want to see how much you think it's worth. But I always said this. I said, I'll put a price down, too, and we'll see how close it was. And you'd be surprised the prices you would get. Lord have mercy. Yeah, that was quite an adventure, I'll tell you. I said about for about 20 years there. I was, never made any money at it.
Ron, I remember back in the early 70s and mid-70s when you were doing fur buying, and I was bringing in all these reds, and I was just wondering why you always called them foot rags.
That foot rag expression comes from Fort Yukon. What they used to do, those natives up there, when they get bad fur, they'd rub fox or something like that, they wouldn't sell it. And what they'd use it for, they'd wrap their boot in that fur. And that's where that expression comes from.
As I said in the intro, Ron had a good sense of humor. He loved to make people laugh. In this next segment, he relates a couple of funny stories from the trap line.
About a year later, I was out there, had this tent, you know, this old wall tent, and there were shrews all over. I don't mean one or two shrews. I mean there were thousands of shrews. And what they'd do, those dirty son of a gun, they'd crawl up the tent. It's just like a horror story. And what they'd do, they'd get right up here and they couldn't hold on no more. And they'd fall right down your sleeping bag. God! Now, I never had one of them bite me, but I was damn sure we'll get them off of there, I'll tell you. Oh, Lord, that was fun.
You ever have one in a sleeping bag with you?
Oh, absolutely. I squashed a few of them, too.
Yeah, so you ever have them run across your face?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Well, I hate that.
Oh, that's terrible. They go like that. Yeah.
I hate that.
Oh, Lord, that's terrible. Bad night. I tell you, it's hard to sleep. Well, Jim Wendell, when I met him, he'd just come back from Vietnam. So he wanted to go trapping with me, and I said, well, sure. So we went out there, and I'd have to go into a little theatrics on this because this is some story. So it's cold, man. It's about 30 or 40 below out. And I'm sitting in one chair there, and Jim's sitting in the chair across the cabin, you know, and I got this 22 pistol. I take out the clip, and I put the clip up on a little shelf up by the stove. I got the pistol out. It had snow in it. I got the receiver back on it, and I'm looking at it, you know, and kind of get the snow out of it. And all of a sudden, boom! And I looked, and I see Wendell go, ugh! And he's going down, and the blood running all over it. I said, oh, my God. I'm looking at this pistol, the receiver's still back on it. The crowning blow, when he's sliding down to the ground, he says, you shot. And then I hear it, boom, boom, boom. Man, I don't know where they're coming from, but I know I'm not shooting them. So I ran out of the cabin. And then it ran back in again. I didn't know what was shooting at me, you know. Holy Lord. Well, finally, I settled down, and I seen what happened. Those bullets that came out of that clip, just perfect, they went right down top of the stove. I mean, quite a few of them went top of the stove. And while I'm sitting there messing with this gun, the first one that got him, the side of the case went out. Bullet really didn't get him. The brass got him. And it went right in his hand, and it was sticking out like this, you know. He thought he'd made it all the way through Vietnam, and I was going to kill him in his cabin. So he was going to chalk. I said, lay down that bed, man, and let me get a bunch of covers over you. So let me look at your hand. And he said, okay, easy. He said, it hurts. I said, no, I'll tell you what, Jimmy. It hasn't started swelling yet. I think I can cut that out in this side. God, no, don't do that. I said, well, how am I going to do it? I said, it's 40 below out there. He says, I don't care how cold it is. He said, you get that snow machine going. And he said, I'll hang on. I said, with one hand? He said, yeah, I'll hang on. Get me back to town. I said, okay. So I got one of those skidoos. They froze up about every 20 miles. You'd have to take a torch and warm up the carburetor. So here we go, and I'm riding this thing, and he's got this old folder sled. He's holding on with one hand, man, and he's got a death grip on that baby. We made it all the way back to town, and he never fell off. We got him in town, and he never went to trap with me again after that.
That was the damnest thing I ever seen. Yeah, it was Jim Wendell.
Ron was also a hunter. Here he describes his most memorable moose hunts. If you're like me, you can almost see that big bull. Ron then wraps up today's interview.
I know you've done a lot of moose hunting over in that country.
Oh, yes.
Your favorite stories about that?
Like day one. It was about 1961. I was over there, and it was late in the year. I was gotten for an hour ride at that time, and we didn't have any meat. All the clients had taken out all the meat. And I needed some meat. I used to have a cabin over there, a place called Daniel Creek. So I went over there, and I'm looking around, and here's this bull. I guarantee you, the biggest bull that you ever saw. Remember, this is in October, and this bull is in full rut, man. I mean, he is huge son of a gun. I looked at him, I said, oh God, would I like to kill that thing, but I'd need the meat. I said, make the story short, I killed another one. A year later, I'm almost at the same place where it was a month earlier. I'm glassing. I looked across the valley, and this country has a lot of old uprooted roots sticking up. And here's this great big root. Looked at it a little more. All of a sudden, that root went like this. I said, holy mackerel, there that baby is again. I said, I ain't gonna get away this time. So I'm shooting across the valley now, you understand. I used to shoot a Wildcat. It was a 33-38. It was a forerunner of the 300 Winchester Magnum. And I said, well, I'll give it a try. It's a long ways over there, boy. Boom, my shot. Up he jumps, off he goes in the other direction. God, no. I said three or four prayers. Boom. Now he's getting way over there. I missed him again. I said, oh, God. Well, anyway, get the story short. The third shot, I got him. Down he went. Now, just how nuts I was. Now, that's about a mile, a half, 2 miles of the strip. So I'm walking over there to this moose. And I knew at the time he was close to the world record. He's talking about packing out some moose meat. God almighty. But anyway, that moose was 19 of the world records at the time. Now, I think he's probably 23 or 24 in Boone Crockett. But he was a huge moose. He was 72 inches. He got brow palms. Is that wide on both sides? The spikes off the brow palms about that long. He was a magnificent moose. But that country was always very good for moose. I've hunted in there since the late 50s. It's always been real good moose country.
Any comments about the value of this outdoor lifestyle to you and your family?
Well, it's been my lifestyle, my life. You know, I went through a few marriages and everything else just because I liked the outdoors. The women were second, the outdoors were first. You know what I mean? That's a pretty rash statement. No, I've always enjoyed it, and I always had a heck of a time. My kids enjoyed it. My kids went out with me many times. I got a place up in the mountains. They still go up there and go hunting. No, Alaska's been very good to me, and I hope it continues to be good to me for quite a few more years. That's it.
We're at the end of today's program. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Tune in again next week for another edition of Alaska Tracks.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Rod Saw Shop. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.